Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll have a conversation with American soprano Ellie Dane, who makes her San Francisco opera debut in the title role of Jules Massenet's Manon Lescaut. It'll be conducted by Patrick Fournillier and directed by Vincent Boussard. From the Young People's Symphony Orchestra, we'll talk with music director and conductor David Ramadanov and guest violinist Ariel Horowitz to talk about their upcoming fall concert. On the program, a healthy helping of Dvorak, Prokofiev, and Tchaikovsky. No collusion imagined, I imagine. Also stopping by is award-winning choreographer and performer Jess Curtis, a return visitor to Open Air to discuss the ensemble's seventh biennial performance event, Intercontinental Collaborations No. 7, presented by Gravity, which runs at the Joe Good Annex. We'll also be joined by guest choreographer Tara Brandel from Cork, Ireland. Also, writer and performer Kate Robards shares details about her new autobiographical one-woman show, Ain't That Rich, in which she describes growing up poor in an East Texas town and marrying into the 1%. Interesting show at the Marsh. Stay with us here at KLW. Some music from Remote by Matthias Hermann, which is being presented as part of Intercontinental Collaborations No. 7. Jess Curtis, Gravity, presenting this. An evening of repertory-length works created and curated by Gravity's artistic director, Jess Curtis, in an evening of performance that crosses genres, issues, and continents. Here to talk about these works is Jess Curtis, an award-winning choreographer and performer who is committed to art-making practice that is informed by experimentation, innovation, critical discourse, and social relevance. He's created and performed multidisciplinary dance theater throughout the U.S. and Europe, and in 2000 he founded his own transcontinental performance company, Jess Curtis Gravity, based in Berlin and San Francisco. In 2011, he was presented the prestigious Albert Award in the Arts for Choreography and the Homer Avila Award for Innovation in Physically Inclusive Dance. He holds an MFA in Choreography and a PhD in Performance Studies from UC Davis. A pleasure to welcome Jess back to our airwaves. Hey, Jess.
Hi, David. Nice to be here again.
He's joined by Tara Brandel, who is Artistic Director of the Croyglan Integrated Dance, just completed a two-year residency. You're going to have to help me with some of these pronunciations, Tara.
It's the Ellen.
Ellen West Cork Arts Center, including a retrospective exhibition of some 25 years of her choreography. She performed Gawky and Awkward at the San Francisco International Arts Festival and has been commissioned to choreograph a site-specific integrated dance quartet at the DCAF Festival in Cairo in 2017. Her short dance film, Car, will screen at the Contact Dance International Film Festival in Toronto in April, or is that past tense?
Yes, past tense.
This past April. And she's currently touring her new solo dance theater show, Kafka Glass. Did I get that right?
Yes, perfect.
Which looks at the current refugee crisis in Europe and our sense of displacement and belonging. Welcome to you, Tara.
Thank you.
Jess, I'm kind of curious. First of all, welcome back.
Yes,
thank you. I'm kind of curious, is there a personal story that has informed your work for our differently abled fellow artists?
It's mostly a story of having met a number of artists through teaching. I was in the early 2000s, I was in a circus, and the director of a company in the UK invited me to come teach an aerial workshop for physically diverse participants. So, and asked me, can we do that? And I met through teaching aerial work to a number of people with disabilities and artists. I met a number of professional artists in the UK, and was really taken by specific movement qualities that they had and them as performers, and invited a couple of them, Claire Cunningham, who was here with us the last time I was here, Kaz Langley, and invited them into my work, and have just been really, that for me, that my casts are often very diverse in a number of different ways, and making work from the body, I think it's really interesting to have a diverse set of bodies that bring their lived experience to the making of any work.
So let's talk about how this particular program came together.
This program came together, I have a alternating rhythm in my production cycles. That last year we had a really big premiere with Claire Cunningham, and in the off years I often have shorter works that, for instance, Tara and Krieglan commissioned this piece remote from me for their 10th anniversary, and it hadn't had the opportunity to play in America, and so we, as kind of a co-producer, invited them to come and do the U.S. premiere here.
Nice. It had its premiere in Cork in 2016.
It did. Yeah, last summer it had its world premiere, and now this is its U.S. premiere. So that's that piece, and then another piece. Often in these years of repertory work, I invite collaborators from my work. So Rachel Dichter has been in a number of Gravity pieces, and the piece A Portrait of Me as You is her work, but a really fierce, beautiful solo that I love a lot that hasn't been seen enough. So we're producing that. And then I'm making a new piece called Sight Unseen that is a kind of 25-minute experimental work I think people will really enjoy.
And those are interesting also because you're going to have a couple of an ASL interpreted performance on Saturday, November 4th, and a pre-show touch tour at 7. So tell us.
Right. Actually, the ASL perform the sign language interpreted performances on Sunday. On Saturday night, we have a pre-show touch tour for visually impaired patrons, and Lighthouse for the Blind has been working with us to make the work more accessible to people with visual impairments. Central to the experiment is a interaction with language. The dancers describe things that they're doing while they do them. So there's a whole layer of text in the piece that is helping, on one level, helping people with visual impairments to know what's going on. And then we also have an audio description track that people will be able to hear that night. But in general, working in with a number of different artists, particularly Claire from last year, but I've started to really be concerned with making my performance work more accessible across sort of different sensory modalities, so not just leaving people out. And my experience in the UK, as I've been working there a fair bit, there's much more practice of making sure that you have a night with an ASL interpreter or a night that's audio described. And that practice is really not done here very much at all with very much performance in the States.
So. Right. Well, we're fortunate in the Bay Area to have, be in a particular place, especially San Francisco, that's very accommodating. Mm-hmm. But you've discovered across the country that's really not the case.
And actually, in the theater milieu in San Francisco, it's really hard to find ASL signed performances, and almost no audio description in any theater that we've been calling. We're actually working on a program to offer a mobile audio description set up for small theaters to be able to do in the future.
Well, the Lighthouse for the Blind is a great resource. I'm glad you're working with
them. They're really great.
Super folks. I used to do some reading for them a few years back. Tara, let's talk about this piece called Remote.
Yes.
How did the concept come to you? And
created?
So, as Jess said, it was made for our 10th anniversary show, which we toured around Ireland last summer. Creaghlan was set up in 2006, and for our first piece, we invited Jess to come and make a duet on the two co-founders at the time. And we came to San Francisco then and performed it, as well as touring it around Ireland.
It was created in a unique way. It wasn't all hands-on, in-person creation, I understand.
This show remote, yes. Because it's about digital media, we set up a Facebook page, and we did some of it through kind of discussing between the three of us. Linda is the other performer in the piece from Creaghlan, and so Jess, Linda, and I, and sometimes Matthias, the composer, would write between us on the Facebook page. And then in rehearsals in West Cork in Ireland, Matthias was Skyped in to the rehearsals, so he was kind of creating music for us virtually
from his studio in Berlin. Yeah. So he's still actually not met Tara or Linda in person, and that's been kind of
it's funny. The brave new world we're in, I think.
It is.
It's a wonderful way to collaborate with people, though.
Yes.
Undiscovered.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been great to work with Jess again on this second piece for Creaghlan, and yeah, I'm really excited to perform it tonight.
Changes from what was presented in Cork then, or is it the same work essentially?
No, it's the same work, yeah. Yeah, this is about our sixth venue, I think. I think we did five venues in Ireland. And so the piece has really had time to settle and grow, mm-hmm. and it's great to be doing it here.
So this is a duet with Linda Farren. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you're interacting then.
So Linda Farren is a dance artist with a disability from Belfast, and she's been working with Creaghlan now for about 3 years, although she was already a very experienced dancer when we met her. She trained with Liminous Soul in Belfast. We're working a lot in the piece with our cell phones. And so we interact through our cell phones, and we interact with the audience through our cell phones. And yeah, there's a kind of playfulness in that, but also, I think, kind of a poignancy in that.
And what other music will we hear as a part of this performance?
In this performance, Matthias made another piece that I think you're going to play us out with. That is Matthias is a cellist, is his primary instrument. And this is a piece that you actually, if it's the one I understand, it's the one that actually you hear from Tara's cell phone as she dances with her cell phone. So it comes out of the phone. And
neat. Okay, well, we'll have a listen to that. Once again, Jess Curtis / Gravity presents Intercontinental Collaboration featuring Creaghlan. Now I got it.
It means clear heart in Irish.
Clear heart. Creaghlan. Mm-hmm. Nice. Integrated dance from Ireland, which is Tara Brandel, who's here in studio, and Linda Farren, and a special duet. Choreographer, performer Rachel Dichter, movement artists Celine Alwyn, Gabriel Christian, Tiffany Taylor, Sherwood Chen, and actor activist Tiffany Taylor. Tell us a little bit about Tiffany Taylor, would you?
Tiffany's great. I met Tiffany last year. She came to see a performance of ours, or she attended a performance of ours with the Lighthouse for the Blind group that came with Lighthouse for the Blind. And then she came and started taking contact improvisation dance classes with me after that, and took a bunch of those, and then took an intensive, a performance intensive that I taught in the spring. And I invited her into this project. She's visually impaired and has been really a fantastic addition to our crew, and she also works for us as an access consultant, helping us to make sure the work to really think through, okay, what are people with visual impairments taking away from what they hear in this situation, or how can we make different things more accessible and more interesting? And in the piece, we set up the room so that the audience is actually seated throughout the room, and we move in and amongst them, so you have tactile and sonic information about the dance that's happening all around you. And Tiffany's been really fantastic, and she's trained as an actor, but she's been really game picking up a lot of dance moves from the rest of the cast.
Nice. And with some terrific original music by Matthias Herman tonight at 8, Friday at 8 Saturday and Sunday at 8, Sunday matinee as well as at 5. It's at the Joe Good Annex on Alabama Street. JessCurtisGravity.org for more information. Here's some more music of Matthias Hermann to round things out. Intercontinental Collaborations, number 7. Jess Curtis, Tara Brendel, thanks for coming in today, and I look forward to catching the performance.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Correction to my previous announcement about the dates. They are 8 p.m. performances tonight, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Joe Good Annex. Jess Curtis, Gravity Presents Intercontinental Collaborations, number 7. Flavor of the extremely enthusiastically performed Carnival Overture by Antonín Dvořák on a program that also features Prokofiev's Violin Concerto and Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4. It's the Young People's Symphony Orchestra that will kick off its 81st season with this fall concert, featuring guest violinist Ariel Horowitz and conductor David Ramadanov. The concert is this Saturday at 8 p.m. at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. Joining me in studio, it's a pleasure to welcome back Maestro Ramadanov, who actually conducted the Prokofiev First Violin Concerto as associate conductor of the San Francisco Symphony with no less than Isaac Stern as soloist in the late 1970s. He's joined here in studio by soloist Ariel Horowitz. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, David, how long have you been leading the Young People's Symphony Orchestra?
This is my 29th season.
And give us a little history of the orchestra, if you would.
It is the oldest youth orchestra in California, the second oldest in the country. And the oldest youth orchestra in the country is the Portland Philharmonic. And there was an amateur harpist named Clarabelle Bell, who happened to be the mother of cellist Bonnie Hampton, who went and heard the Portland Philharmonic and came back and said to a violinist conductor friend of his, you've got to form one of these. And so that's how it got started. There was a brief interruption, I think, during the Second World War, but it has been going ever since the mid-1930s.
And how are the young people chosen for the orchestra?
Through audition.
How often is that?
There are two sets of auditions in the spring and then follow-up auditions in the fall.
And Ariel, you've had quite a number of concerto performances under your belt already with the Baltimore Symphony, the Lincoln Center Chamber Orchestra, Carmel Symphony, Chamber Orchestra, Kremlin, and the Doctors Orchestral Society of New York, also as a recitalist around the world, really, performing not only contemporary works, but the classical genre, stalwarts. How did you come across this opportunity to play with the Young People's Symphony Orchestra?
I came across this opportunity from a competition that I am a prize winner of, the Klein Competition. They're an incredible organization, and they do so much for young string players. And they wrote me, and they said, there's this opportunity to perform Prokofiev Violin Concerto No. 1 with the Young People Symphony Orchestra. And I jumped at the opportunity. I was so excited. This is a piece that I've studied. I studied it about 4 years ago when I was a senior in high school, and I never really got a chance to perform it. And I've always kind of been itching to find an opportunity to do so and to really get deeper into the music. So this was such an incredible opportunity. I'm very grateful.
Well, we know the Klein Competition quite well. I've worked under conductor Mitchell Sardou Klein of the Peninsula Symphony. We just had our concerts this past weekend, and he's very much involved in his namesake father's concerto competition. So it's wonderful that you had the opportunity through the Klein Competition to share your talents with us.
Thank you.
So maybe since you have your fiddle here, tell us about your the instrument you're using, and maybe we can hear a little couple of the samples from the Prokofiev, if you'd be so kind.
Of course. I'm very, very fortunate to play this instrument. I've been playing it for almost 3 years. I'm unfortunately not at liberty to say what it is, but it's really, really beautiful.
It's not carbon fiber. Let's put it that
way. It's not carbon fiber, but I love it. It's my soulmate.
Wow.
He's a very finicky boy. I have to take him to the shop quite often because
really?
He's very old.
Okay.
And he gets, you know, joint pain and back pain. So he's a high-maintenance buddy, but he does the job quite well.
And he doesn't have bridge for his teeth, but the bridge problems are from the bridge for the strings.
Yeah, exactly. No, we got to, you know, we got to glue him up every now and again and get his dentures in, and yeah, for sure.
It sounds like I'm going to be like this violin before too long.
But oh, no.
No, go, please, tell us more.
Okay, we're all headed there some point or another.
So let's hear, maybe what would you like to play?
I'll play a bit of the opening of the first movement of the Prokofiev Concerto.
Great. I'm going to give you a little bit of Carnegie Hall in the background. How about that?
Nice.
Fantastic. The little Carnegie Hall here with me still. Let me turn the hall down. That's live in RKLW studios. Ariel Horowitz performing part of the Prokofiev Concerto No. 1. Boy, David, I say that's Isaac Stern worthy. Do you recall a similarity?
Oh, no.
They're very different in temperament, but she holds her own very, very well. Uh-huh. I mean, it's absolutely lovely playing.
Well, we can't talk about the incredible violin solo part without some of the amazing orchestration that Prokofiev offers in all of his works.
Well, the amazing thing in the way that this piece is written is that the violin really almost becomes part of the orchestra and emerges from time to time. And that, I think, is one of the things that was a little bit of a puzzle for my players, because they're feeling bits and pieces. How do we fit in? But then the solo line really makes it complete. And but then it all really comes together. Mm-hmm. And then there are times when she actually accompanies the flute playing the melody that she just played at the end of the first movement.
I've got my flute here, but I don't think we have the music.
Next time.
We'll have to imagine that. Could you perhaps offer us some of the more technical aspects of the concerto that are going to come our way when we hear it?
Sure. It's really challenging, but not in the way that you would think violin music is usually challenging. Like when you think of Paganini or Wieniawski or any of this music that you kind of associate with virtuosity. Prokofiev uses a lot of extended techniques, such as left-hand pizzicato. He uses a lot of harmonics. A lot of the more scalar passages or more virtuosic passages are not necessarily very violinistically intuitive. So a lot of the muscle memory that I've gained over my, 17 years of violin playing at this point is kind of useless when it comes to trying to learn something like this. But it's all so structured, and it makes so much sense once you figure it out. And that texture that those extended techniques provide really gives such voice to exactly what the maestro was talking about, how the violin is really such a part of the orchestra. And I really like that about this piece. It makes it feel much more like chamber music rather than just like me standing awkwardly in front of a group of people playing fast notes. It's more holistic.
Well, among your prominent teachers are Itzhak Perlman. Did he offer anything specific about Prokofiev and your technique?
I actually didn't study this piece with him. I studied the second violin concerto with him during my freshman year at Juilliard, and he's such a great guy. I miss him a lot. I'm at Yale now, so I graduated, so I no longer study with him. But in the second violin concerto, which is actually a bit more standard, I remember him talking to me just about like sound projection. When I was a freshman, I didn't have as big of a sound as I do now, and he got really frustrated at one point. He was like, if you play that in a hall, no one's going to hear you. They're going to think you're a little pipsqueak mosquito. And I was like, well, I'll be darned if I'll be a pipsqueak mosquito. So I got a bigger sound, and I thank him for that.
That's nice. So let's hear a little bit of technical aspect of the concerto, as or whatever you'd like to play from the concerto. Or another excerpt.
Oh, sure. I'll just keep going where I left off.
Okay, sure, a little bit more. Indeed, from Klein Competition winner Ariel Horowitz. Ariel, thank you for sharing some of your virtuosity playing here. David, what a treat this concert's going to be. Ariel, I also want to ask you about your commitment to the Heartbeat Project. Tell us about the Heartbeat Project.
Sure. The Heartbeat Project is an organization that I started that provides music education to K-12 students living on the Navajo Reservation. It's an issue that's very close to my heart and very close to my family. Both my mom and my aunt, her sister, are indigenous rights activists, as well as activists for many other causes. And activism is something that has been impressed upon me from a young age. And my mom was working on the reservation, and they said that they really wanted to have an arts education program to help their youth become more competitive in American society and also just in a more global context. And my mom said, well, my kid would do it. So I have gone out to the Navajo reservation for the past 2 summers. The project has grown immensely. The first summer, it was just me and my friend Lironi and 7 third graders. And this past summer, we had a total of 6 faculty and 25 students from kindergarten through, I think our oldest student was a freshman in college. And we were able to have 9 violins donated to the reservation. And a lot of our students are continuing their studies during the year, which is really exciting. So we're hoping to go back and expand the program even bigger. It's something that really helps me find meaning in my artistic voice.
That's fantastic. Where can people learn more about this project?
To learn more about this particular project, we're working on building a website. Stay tuned, but okay. We do have a Facebook page, facebook.com/theheartbeatproject2017.
Very nice. Well, I wish you a wonderful performance this coming Saturday with the amazing Prokofiev concerto. David, let's talk a bit about the program. We heard a little bit of Dvorak. We heard some of the Prokofiev. We're going to end with some of the Tchaikovsky. I don't know, though, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev. Should we have Robert Mueller look into this collusion with the Young People's Symphony Orchestra or this Russian invasion? I don't know. What's going on here?
No, it's really just a matter of wanting to do great repertoire with these young people and also just something that really involves everyone. And Tchaikovsky and Dvorak both involve my entire orchestra, including the percussion and the low brass. So I
imagine the look on Putin's face when he realizes that his greatest composer, Tchaikovsky, is gay. I can't imagine being in the same room when that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. If he's in denial, it's more than a river in Egypt, I'd say. Mm. The Tchaikovsky, as I well know, is, as a piccolo player, has quite a passage to compete, to project once. I remember distinctly there's a wonderful video that MTT, Michael Tilson Thomas, did with the San Francisco Symphony, where you can just see the look of relief on Robin's face, on Kathy Payne's face when the solo is done. She just sits back, she's like, did it, got it.
I remember that. And I know she talked about the fact that it was a terrifying experience every time that she would play it. But those excerpts were on our auditions this year. And along with the difficult first clarinet solos that were in the third movement. So we have a wonderful young new piccolo player named Lita Knowles, who is doing beautifully with those solos.
Very nice. Once again, the concert is the Young People's Symphony Orchestra this Saturday, November 4th at 8 p.m. at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. Conductor David Ramadanov leads the orchestra with the guest violinist Ariel Horowitz for the Prokofiev Concerto No. 1, Tchaik 4, and Dvorak Carnival Overture on the program. Thanks for coming in to share, and we'll see you again soon with your next project.
Thank you so much.
And Ariel, please keep us engaged as to your activities as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Just a taste of the amazing scherzo movement of the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4, which will be presented by the Young People's Symphony Orchestra this Saturday at 8 p.m. at the First Congregational Church of Berkeley. Maestro David Ramadanov leading the way. And the ypsomusic.org for more information. The San Francisco Opera continues its season with performances of Jules Massenet's Manon Lescaut, opening Saturday and running for six performances through November 22nd. Soprano Ellie Dane makes her debut role as Manon. She's previously appeared at San Francisco Opera in the roles of Countess Almaviva in La Nozze di Figaro, Donna Anna in Don Giovanni, Fior di Ligi in Così fan tutte, Michaela and Carmen and Musetta and La Boheme, which we'll hear in just a moment. Recent successes include her Royal Opera, Covent Garden debut, the title role in Rasulka with the Lyric Opera of Kansas City, Falstaff with San Diego Opera, and her Opera Köln debut as Donna Anna, La Scala debut as Antonia in The Tales of Hoffman. She's also performed at the Metropolitan Opera and was a regular special guest on A Prairie Home Companion, which we'll hear more about in my conversation with her the other day at the War Memorial Opera House. Here she is in a brief excerpt from her most recent appearance here. Just heard a very brief excerpt from your beautiful performance as Musetta and Musetta's waltz in your recent production here at the San Francisco Opera. That must be one of the most fun roles to play in opera.
Absolutely. It is one of the most luxurious roles I've ever sung because, one, it's very short, and two, you get to steal the show in the second act. So anytime I get an offer, I take it immediately.
Well, this is a very busy season, which not only sees your return here for a role debut as Manon, but a company debut for Dallas Opera next spring. You'll be doing Musetta and San Carlo in January. Same production, by the way?
Different production, but I was just in Naples this past year. So I believe it's the same production we did 1 year ago.
Nice. And an interesting production of an opera by Elena Langer that adds a third opera to the Figaro story. Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, of course, Rossini's The Barber of Seville, and it's called Figaro Gets a Divorce, which you just did this past September, which also marked a return for you to the Grand Théâtre de Genève. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, actually, as it life can happen sometimes, I found out about that opera pretty late in the game. Maybe 2 months before I found out about this Manon, I found out about that. So I had two major roles to prepare in about 6 weeks after that Boheme this summer. So I definitely had my work cut out for me. But the music was actually quite good, and we had a fantastic group of people. The libretto was by the book by David Poutney, who's WNO, and he's directed here at San Francisco and all over the world, obviously. But it was a great show, actually, and the more performances we had, the more people came. So that's always good for a modern piece. We like to see that.
So tell us a little bit about the music. Does Elena pay tribute or at least referencing a little bit of Mozart or Rossini, or is it her own?
In general, it wasn't 12-tone. It was on a more easy listening scale, let's say.
And hopefully a lot of fun.
Oh, we had a fantastic group of people, and we had a ball. Yes, it was a great time.
So on to your role debut as Manon here at the San Francisco Opera, following in the footsteps or the heels of some very wonderful singers, Ruth Ann Swenson, Beverly Sills, as well as Sherry Greenewald.
That's right. Yeah, she's still here with the Marylove program.
Tell us a little bit about the preparation for the role of Manon. For those that don't know the story, who is Manon Lescaut?
So Manon Lescaut is a simple girl. Well, we learned she's probably not quite so simple from the beginning, but she has been told by her family to join the convent and sent to find her cousin. And you can tell she has an impetus for pleasure and for trouble, and she has her eyes set on something bigger. So we just watch her journey become this girl with a lot of charm and a lot of wit, and we see her climb and actually truly fall in love, but her drive for fame and riches overwhelms that at one point.
Do we know the backstory of why she was heading off to the convent in the first place?
Well, in the first duet with the tenor, she does say that she liked pleasure too much. So I'm not sure if there was an event that happened or if the family just sensed she was going to be trouble.
How does this square, as you're preparing for Manon, with the way director Vincent Boussard thought of the role?
I actually love Vincent. He has been such a fantastic force to collaborate with for my first Manon. He stays very true to the text. So there's nothing that we do, even though it's a newer production. Everything that we say is what we mean, which I think is very helpful in not only getting the role into your body and memorizing it, but in character development as well. You don't have to, you know, have some kind of abstract concept that you're trying to figure out your own solution. So he's just been a wealth of information and knowledge and wonderful to work with.
Because he's sort of placed it in not just in a specific time period of the opera's origin.
Exactly. It could really be any time period. And there's kind of a juxtaposition with some of the costuming and set choices. But it's also period. I mean, you'll see in the costumes that, you know, he's definitely done his research. And there's a lot of beautiful things happening up there.
Speaking of research, I understand that you spent a little time in Paris exploring the places that Manon is featured.
I did, yes. I was lucky enough, being in Geneva, to be very close and had some friends there. And we did a little photo shoot. We went to Saint-Sulpice. I got to walk along the Cour de Rennes. And just, you know, a lot of the places actually in Manon don't exist anymore. But, you know, just being there and getting to see some of the places, I think, really helped.
I should mention that the program book for Manon also includes a sort of a, you could use it as a tour book as well. It mentions several of the places in Manon that you can visit, including Saint-Sulpice, which has, I didn't realize, the largest church in Paris. It's huge.
It is
incredible
huge.
Delacroix paintings and amazing stained glass. So well worth a visit, and you have your own little guidebook in terms of your program guide, your program book. My first operatic experience also happens to have been Manon. I had a very enlightened high school English teacher, freshman English teacher, who took me to see Manon at the Met.
Oh, wow. Who was the Manon?
I have no idea. Oh. I just remember the experience. I remember checking out records and listening to it in advance. I remember the trip down to New York. And this was also the pre-subtitled Met, so it was quite a challenge for a high school kid to grasp onto.
The good thing about Manon, though, is the tunes are all identifiable in some way. I mean, it's very accessible, even though the opera is long. And I congratulate you for sitting through it as a younger child. But, yeah, I mean, it's I would recommend it for a first or second opera, although the length would be the only part you would worry about for somebody who isn't that familiar with opera. But, I mean, the music is fantastic. Mm-hmm.
You're also working with the French conductor on this production, Patrick Fournillier. Keeps you on your toes, or en point, I imagine.
He does, yes. He's very specific of what he wants. What's very interesting is there are a lot of different versions of the score. There have been certain traditions, for example, you know, fermatas on certain notes, tenuti, rhythm changes that have changed from edition to edition. So we're using, you know, his orchestral, and he's a Massenet expert. So there have been some changes that we've all made during the process, but I think it's, you know, it's turned out to be quite good. I mean, he's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. You're also working with Michael Fabiano, with whom I understand you went to school with at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia.
I did. He's younger than I am. And so AVA was a school that it's not on age. We just have first year through fourth years. So he reminded me that I had hazed him a little bit when he first got there because he had mono. And I think I told him to stay away from all of the singers, which I totally have forgotten, but it stuck with him. So it's been fun watching him become, you know, this major name in opera. And he's always been a star. I mean, he's always had the charisma and the voice. So, yeah, it's great to. We never got to sing with each other actually at school. So, it's fun now, all these years later, to get to sing together.
Yeah, well, he's no stranger to the San Francisco Opera stage. And I understand that San Francisco Opera has also been a great place for you to take on a new role.
That's very true. Yes. I had done the Mozart Heroines prior, but Mikaela was able to be a role debut for me, and possibly something in the future. We'll see if, you know, what comes. But yes, they have absolutely been fantastic with giving me opportunities.
You did allude to the length of Manon Lescaut, and I think you've likened preparation for the role to almost like training for a marathon.
Absolutely. I mean, it is double the length of Traviata, the role. I mean, the role of Violetta. It is, I mean, you really have to take it act by act. Otherwise, it is completely overwhelming. I mean, Beverly Sills called this role the French Isolde. It is not lenient. You have to sing balls to the walls all night. So it's been a lesson in pacing a bit, but it's written in such a way you never have to push the voice. The orchestration is really well done. But yes, it is definitely, the stamina is real. You have to work on it, for sure.
Well, I mentioned this being my first operatic experience. You came from a musical family. You played piano at a very early age in Anoka, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Your grandfather was I'm a flutist as well. Your grandfather was a flutist with the Minneapolis Orchestra for 42 years. So
yes.
Music was always around you in the early years.
Yes, he actually, he grew up in New York, near New York City, and he was going to get kicked out of school for being just a thug, you know, an Italian thug. And his punishment was joining the orchestra or the band and playing the flute. And I think they, you know, they thought that that would maybe get him into shape. And he got into Juilliard the next year, so it ended up working out quite well for him. Yeah, and he was with the Minnesota Orchestra for 42 years.
But you yourself didn't come to singing, especially operatic singing, until a little bit later.
Right. I was always in choir. I loved musical theater. But I can't dance or act, which I've said many times before. Opera acting is a little bit different than straight acting. I found that singing was something I was good at. And then I learned more and more about opera and fell in love with it from there.
Is Anoka, Minnesota, one of those places where it's good to be from?
I think it has its charms, sure. I love the Twin Cities. I think it's a great place to live.
Mm-hmm. I understand there's another rather infamous member of Anoka, Minnesota, also in the radio business.
Yes, that would be Garrison Keillor. And he has been absolutely wonderful to me. He actually was at the Met in a production of Don Giovanni where I was singing Donna Elvira, and he saw that I was from Anoka in the program and had me on the show a bunch of times. And we've been in touch ever since. And he's a huge opera fan, actually.
Didn't know that.
A huge opera fan, yes. So he is not coming to this show, but he's seen others, and we've gone to the Met together, and, you know, he's just an absolute, I mean, a force to be reckoned with. I mean, his what he's done for radio and writing is incredible, and he keeps going. He hasn't retired yet. He's still going.
Indeed. Well, I just think you've got a few years ahead of you yourself in terms of some preparation for some major roles coming up. We so look forward to hearing you as Manon and your debut role at the San Francisco Opera, Puccini's Manon Lescaut, and we hope
Massenet, that is.
And down the road when you're here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Of course. Let's hear one of those Prairie Home Companion appearances in a skit on the advantages of being a diva.
All right, let's come in here with a very important message, and I want you people to listen up here, because you can learn from this.
Do you feel overlooked and neglected by others? Are you ignored in meetings? Do people act as if you don't exist? Believe me, they'll pay attention when you learn to be loud. Like this. Probably your parents told you to keep your voice down, and so you did, and you became a wimp. Well, it's time to take back your power. Don't be a doormat, be a diva.
Miss Dean, I'm sorry, but your car isn't ready right now. We can have it ready in 15 minutes, okay? Okay, so it's you. I'm sorry. Joe, bring up Miss Dean's car. There you go, Miss Dean.
It's okay to be quiet in Minnesota, but when you go to New York, there are times when you need to be emphatic.
Excuse me, coming through. Watch your back. Watch your back. Here
this
we go.
Is on the line. I'm standing in line. The rear is back there. Go back there, or I will cause you. Pain.
Whoa, sorry, I didn't see you. Have a nice day. Bye. Okay, bye.
Some people think diva means being self-centered, petulant, demanding. No. Diva means when the going gets tough, the tough get tougher. It means standing up for what's right and true. In SOS, the Sisterhood of Sopranos, diva is a matter of self-respect. Women have been called divas for hundreds of years, so accept it. Embrace your divahood.
Excuse me, but I think you...
Shut up! Sometimes there are times when a person must speak, or else let the jerk simply rule the world. And then, if you speak, we will need to speak rather loud, and it helps if you can break some glass.
Diva Ellie Dean in a Prairie Home Companion appearance with fellow Anoka Minnesotan radio personality and big opera buff Garrison Keillor. On the serious side, Ellie makes her role debut in Massenet's Manon Lescaut, opening Saturday and running for 6 performances through November 22nd. Information at sfopera.com. Well, the Marsh here in San Francisco welcomes a new solo show, Ain't That Rich, by Kate Robards. A favorite of the 2016 Capital Fringe Fest in D.C., the show was named one of the best of Fringe by the D.C. Metro Theater Arts and won first prize in the 2017 Maui Fringe Festival. In this work, Kate describes growing up poor in an East Texas town and how marrying into the 1% doesn't necessarily by happiness. Kate Robards is an award-winning writer and performer who has lived around the world, including Amsterdam and Shanghai, but identifies deeply with Orange, Texas, a small Gulf Coast town on the Texas-Louisiana border where she spent the first 20 years of her life and is the basis of her solo work, Ain't That Rich. Kate, welcome, if ever so briefly, to Open Air this week.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun just listening to everyone you've had on your show.
Oh, good. Well, I understand you have a little bit of a diva background to you yourself.
Yeah. You know, the way that I first left my hometown of Orange, Texas was I stayed nearby for college. And when I graduated, I started asking everyone, you know, do you know a way that I could get out? And my high school choir teacher said, You should meet Chad Shelton. He calls himself the White Trash Tenor. I got him a vocal performance scholarship to LSU. From LSU, he went to Yale, the Ivory League.
Wow.
The Ivory League, as we call it, because not a lot of people in my hometown go to Yale.
But, Ivory League.
So I worked for almost 2 years for Ana Maria Martinez, a Grammy Award-winning opera singer who has sang at the San Francisco Opera. And I got to travel the world, you know, Amsterdam for 3.5 months, Chicago for 3.5 months. And I saw everything wide-eyed and for the first time with her son.
Wow.
As her nanny. So that was my introduction to opera and really the world.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about Ain't That Rich. Marrying into the 1%, is that partially autobiographical?
Yeah, you know, I do autobiographical work. And I always use the word poor in air quotes because it's like, what is poor? But being around money and having, it was like it's a culture shock in and of itself, because when I was around the opera diva, obviously I met a lot of really wealthy donors and, but I was working for them. So it was like all of a sudden I'm attending these things as a guest and just kind of like the mindset of like, oh, you're really rich. And I've learned that rich people don't like to be called rich, you know, kind of like poor people don't like to be called poor, you know, that they, and how picky people can get, kind of like one of the last things that you're supposed to talk about is money, right? And it was really fun, and it is really fun to play with audiences and ask them if they are rich, because what does that mean, you know?
Well, yeah, what is that definition?
And there's cultural capital, and you know, I always say I had a single mom, but I have had a library card, and I have a library card, and you can have access to different types of wealth in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I offered a brief snapshot of the show, but tell us a little bit more about the characters that you inhabit in the show.
Yeah, you know, I play a lot of characters. It's really a conversation with me, and I slip in and out of characters. One of my favorite characters to play is a doctor, and it's a conversation I had at this very fancy fundraiser, and it's her take on, and she has a very different experience, but her take on wealth and poverty mentality. And, you know, I'm not an expert on the wealth gap in America by any means, but it is a very personal narrative. So contrasting that with my take on money and, you know, it's interesting. But some of the themes that are at play is consumerism. You know, growing up, I always realized if you had a really nice item, a signifier, a type of social signifier that says, oh, this person has money or status, and the way that the world treats you differently. And then also, I'm a white blonde woman, and so there's like different circles that I could just finagle my way into. And because of my looks, people might expect that I have also, you know, had a certain lifestyle. And it's you can't always judge a book by its cover.
That's for sure. We've got some interesting music that's part of the show as well, including someone from Oakland.
Yeah, Kamaya. She's really fun.
Tell us about Kamaya.
I love her. She has a song that's called How Does It Feel to Be Rich? And the lyrics are, I've been broke all my life, but now I wonder, how does it feel rich? And so, of course, I went to graduate school at California College of the Arts. I got my MFA in writing. And Kamaya was blowing up when I graduated in 2016. So I had to put her on the show that I worked on when I was in grad school. And yeah, but I since I love talking about money, I love talking about how much wealth you see in the Bay Area. And the Marsh is this wonderful, tiny little theater. And I think there's something so sacred about going into a dark, simple space that, you know, on the one end you have opera, which they have more money than any other show you'll see on Broadway. The budgets, you've got the full orchestra, you've got the cast, the chorus. And then on the other end of the spectrum is a solo performer, where it's a dark, tiny theater that seats 100 people. It's a very intimate story that is, you know, written and performed with one person. And it's really important to me that I stress that the Marsh, which has given me so much because I've developed my show there, I'm doing benefit performances for them on November 17th, November 25th, and December 2nd. So
very nice.
Yeah.
Kate Robards in Ain't That Rich at the Marsh SF Studio on Valencia Street now through December 2nd, Fridays and Saturdays. Fridays at 8, Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Information at themarsh.org. We're going to go out with some of the music of Kamaya. Thanks for coming in, Kate.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful run.
Everybody lose. friends. People change when they grow to be known in the game. I've been waiting to low, spit fire, spit flames. And I came for the throne. Told them once, told them twice.